Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie. Discover the best artisanal foods that America has to offer. Shop for more at manykitchens.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. As usual, we're here at Roberta's Pizza, the home of Heritage Radio Network in Brooklyn. It's very warm, and I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving weekend. But maybe you're looking to change up your cooking routine and get a little bit more adventurous at home. And I have a book right here that can help you out with that. It is Pock Pock, the cookbook. And to talk about it, I have the author, chef owner of Pock Pock. He's a James Beard Award winning chef from 2011. It is Andy Ricker. How are you?
Howdy. Good, thanks.
And we also have the co-writer, Brooklyn-based food writer, also co-author of several books like The Girl and Her Pig with April Broomfield, Morimoto with Masaharu Morimoto, and his name is J.J. Good.
Well done. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for coming, guys. This book is quite an effort. It is, I can't imagine how much work went into it. When I pick it up, it's just like weighty, and when I look through the recipes, each one is preceded by like about 1,000 words of introduction on each of the dishes.
In a good way, though, I hope.
It's amazing. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
How long did this take?
Well, first of all, I think that it's important to remember this is a culmination of a process that started, 25 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
So a lot of the work was done before we actually started doing the book.
Tons of research and recipe
time
testing.
Time spent, yeah. Time in restaurants, all that kind of stuff. And then the actual process of putting the book together and bringing it to the point where it's published now was about 2.5 years.
Wow.
Should have been 2 years, but we... I blew it. I pushed back the. Remember, I pushed.
Oh
back
yeah, you did
it, like, twice. I think so.
I take back that. No.
Yeah.
So how did you get JJ on board with this project?
Well, initially, I didn't know that I was going to do a cookbook,
mm-hmm.
and at first I had a couple of people approach me, a publishing company that we didn't use in the end, and then a couple of writers kind of came my way, and then JJ was introduced to me by Zach Palacio, I think.
I think so.
And then we just kind of met in Portland, talked about it, and we decided to go for it.
You convinced
Andy to write a cookbook?
Not quite. Like, I had this like weird across the country crush on him,
mm-hmm.
and I was like always like trying to figure out how I was gonna like creep into his life,
mm-hmm.
and then there was a wedding in Portland. I was going to a wedding, and Zach put us in touch by email.
Wow.
I got there and we just got along really well.
Cool.
And I was like, oh, have you ever thought of doing cookbook? And of course it probably crossed your mind before.
Yeah, I mean, at the time I'd been talking to somebody else about the idea too, and so the answer was yes. I've been thinking about it.
Well done.
I scored somehow.
That's awesome.
I'm very persuasive. Yeah.
So for the last 2.5 years or so, I understand that you did some travels in Thailand.
I've dragged JJ to Thailand twice now. The first time was just kind of like a smack upside the head and say, hey, what's,
culture
here's
shock.
What's going on.
Yeah.
And then the second time was literally to woodshed and do what we did was in about a 5-week period, we basically recipe tested all the recipes in the book, cooked everything,
wow.
did all the beauty shots, and we did it all in this really neat house out in the countryside near Chiang Mai.
Wow.
That has kind of a cool story too, but it, you know, most of the like really nuts and bolts hard work of doing what you see there came about
in the 5-week on location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got up every day early. Got a coffee at what's the place you always get coffee?
Wawi Coffee.
But what's the other one with the cats and the better coffee?
Aka'ama. Yeah.
And then we hit the market, the Talat Mung Mai, every morning and bought stuff. And then we drove out to the countryside,
mm-hmm.
saw some dogs, saw some cats, doggy kitty. Mm-hmm. And I basically watched Andy cook everything and I, you know, took video and audio and scribbled notes and basically what we were trying to do is take the recipes that he has in his restaurants, which are for his cooks,
mm-hmm.
And just provide more details so someone who's really unfamiliar with it,
right.
like a home cook who's never cooked this kind of food before, like for instance me, could really, you know, take the recipe and follow the recipe and do everything right and get the result that Andy's after.
And the thing about all these recipes were that they started out as recipes when I learned them more or less in the form that you see them in the book, and then I had to extrapolate restaurant recipes out of those original recipes. So what we were doing is we were reverse engineering and getting back to what I started with. And it wasn't as simple as just going back and taking the recipes that I had learned, you know, years ago, because we've expanded on them, refined them, changed certain little aspects of them. So we had to literally reverse engineer
them.
All them back to a place that made sense in the context of a cookbook.
Wow, sounds like an incredible amount of work, especially since a lot of these recipes are not typically written. I read one of the profiles on one of your cooking mentors, Sonny, and how he never uses a recipe in his life. Hmm. And it's just something that's not a written a medium or tradition. It's not a literary tradition.
It seems like in Thailand they do write.
Now, if you go to Thailand and you go to a bookstore, there's thousands of cookbooks mm-hmm. there. But a lot of the food that we're cooking, the people who I learned from.
You're after, these specific dishes. That,
yeah, they learn from their relatives and from their friends, and they don't use recipes.
Right.
So, you know, it's like learning a dish from your grandma who learned it from her grandma,
mm-hmm,
that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
You've watched her make it so many times, you don't have to. You describe how to form meatballs. You just form the damn meatballs.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm glad you didn't write that, JJ. Just form the damn meatballs.
Sometimes Andy told me,
just put form the fucking chicken in the... put the fucking turkey in the oven.
Stop asking me to weigh shit.
So I mentioned that you had a profile on Sonny, but that's actually one of the really cool highlights about this book is that you have contextual... you know, slices of life about different characters that you've become friends with in Thailand. And why did you decide to do that?
For me, it's really important to point out that I didn't make any of this stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
That none of, you know, none of the dishes that I've learned would have been possible to learn without the help of these people over the years. And that not only that, but I wanted to bring attention to the fact that you know, this food exists somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some sort of like fantasy
invention
that I had and mm-hmm. that I made come true. This is based on some real shit. And the people who taught me all this stuff are, you know, chefs have mentors, right? I worked for Rene Redzepi and whatever. And I don't have that. I've got these people. So
absolutely. I like your passage called The Absurdity of Authenticity, and it's interesting that you mention you don't really like to use the words authentic or traditional when describing the food served at Pok Pok and also in this book, but that you're rather more of a copycat.
Right.
And isn't that, though, telling of a certain tradition or a certain style of making that dish that that you're recreating or copying?
The copying thing is funny. It's like, you know, you if your grandmother taught you to make spaghetti meatballs, for instance, and you made spaghetti meatballs to your taste, you wouldn't call it copying. You know, you call it, this is something you've learned, and then you're making something that then exists in this, mm-hmm. in, you know, it looks like spaghetti and meatballs, it tastes like spaghetti and meatballs, it's slightly different, but it fits within that flavor palette of spaghetti and meatballs, right? That's kind of what Andy does. He, you know, he takes a dish, and he doesn't interpret it, he doesn't, like, get creative with it, he doesn't make, you know, lop into a flan or something like that.
You don't make your own version or...
But he doesn't, like, straight rip, you know, he's not, like, ripping off people. You know,
okay.
He like has spent so much time there. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that he can kind of cook in a way that, you know, he's making his own food and that it's to his own taste. But those tastes exist within this palette that would exist in, say, northern Thailand.
I can give you kind of a practical mm-hmm. example of that. So, the khao soi that we make at Pak Pak, that dish exists in Thailand, there's no one way to make it.
Yeah.
You can go to 20 different khao soi restaurants and have 20 different versions. Mm-hmm. And so rather than go, okay, we're going to do the version that exists at this place exactly, first of all, it'd be impossible because you're not going to give me their recipe, right? They're not going to turn it over. But there's a certain sort of array of flavors, right? It's like working with ramen or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's going to be everybody's got a different version, but there's some rules that you follow more or less. So the khao soi that we make at Pak Pak is kind of this amalgam of maybe, you know, four different versions.
Okay.
And there's certain things that I like about one that I don't like about another, or I like better about this. And I have enough of a knowledge about the ingredients that I can tweak a little bit this way or that way,
mm-hmm.
add a little bit of this or a little bit of that, to make it come out the way that I think it would taste the best.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, what I hope to do is to make khao soi so that if you were doing a blind taste test in Chiang Mai, that you would sit down and taste like four different kinds of khao soi from four different places, and ours was one of them. It would just taste like khao soi. You wouldn't go, oh, that's the white dude's khao soi.
Right.
It's just khao soi.
But that's an interesting thing. It's like this whole idea of seasoning to taste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every book says season to taste. Season to taste with salt, season to taste with vinegar. But of course, like, when that happens in a French context or an Italian context, Southern American context, you know that, you know your tastes are what you should follow, you should judge. You know, if something needs salt, you add salt and it tastes better.
Mm-hmm.
But in Thailand, if you were to follow, or if I, as a neophyte, if I were to follow my tastes, I would always add more sugar. You know, I always want things sweeter. So, you know, you do that to a papaya salad that's from the northeast, Isan, then what you get is a papaya salad that tastes so sweet that it's no longer papaya salad from Isan, right? That's part of the defining, you know, quality of this papaya salad. It's really funky, really salty, really spicy. It's mm-hmm. not sweet at all.
So I have another anecdote that we don't talk about in the book. Is I got I went to dinner at Next.
Okay.
When they did their Thai menu,
right?
And they were doing a version of som tam or papaya salad, and I tasted it, and it was, to me, it didn't taste like Thai papaya salad at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was, there was, the flavor balance was for me way out of whack.
Mm.
But as a Westerner, when I tasted it, it was delicious. Like I understood how they got to where they got to by making it. It wasn't spicy enough. It wasn't sour enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
But what they made was a delicious thing. But if they would have made that in Thailand and gave it to a Thai person, that Thai person would have been like, I don't know what to do with this. Right. But it worked really well for the Western palate. And everything I had that night was really delicious, and not much of it tasted like what I would perceive it should taste like in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that perception speaks directly to the first part of your question, which was about authenticity,
mm-hmm.
which is that in the end, if it tastes good, eat it.
Right.
Right. It don't get too caught up in this idea of authenticity,
mm-hmm.
because you're never going to get to that archetypical papaya salad.
Right, and it depends on your surrounding and the context and the customers, and it sounds like these things are kind of unavoidable.
Yeah, and ever-evolving, too.
Ever-evolving. Mm-hmm. You know. Having said that, we actually, you know, I have a pretty firm idea about what I think the papaya salad should taste like.
And your food is quite different from most American-based Thai restaurants, in the sense that for all these flavor calibrations, how would you say it's most different?
I think that it's most different in that these recipes aren't calibrated for commerce.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, they're calibrated for to evoke a certain place and taste, rather than as a way of getting people to buy a lot of food. So, I mean, there's several things that we have on the menu that are, you know, probably a little bit tough for Western palates to take. For instance, maybe the young jackfruit curry that has cha'om, this kind of like funky green that's in it. And it's kind of got this pungent flavor that is not necessarily something we think of as delicious.
Mm-hmm.
But I can afford to do that because I'm not doing this so much for commerce as a lot of the people who are doing Thai restaurants in America are. There, a lot of these folks are, or most of them are immigrants, and they're trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And they've determined what we like.
Right.
And so, by God, they're going to make that because they got to make a living. And they don't need to shoot themselves in the foot by putting cha'om on the menu and making us eat it.
Yet at the same time, maybe they will after.
Well, no, but to be fair, a lot of places actually do have that stuff on the menu. You have to know to order it.
Right,
we go to
right.
places like Si Papai or, you know, Jitlada, and a lot of these places that are more famous, and, you know, and things are changing, which is
great. So try out that stuff. So much to talk about, but we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back.
This one is called It Ain't Hard to Tell by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Please don't say you love me when you do how you do.
At manykitchens.com, you can enjoy decadent caramel brownies, hand-picked teas, and fair trade coffee, oven-roasted chicken pot pies, and so much more. Whether you're planning a dinner party, sending a gift, or just want to try something new and delicious, Many Kitchens offers something for everyone. Help support small batch producers while you discover the best in artisanal foods from across the nation at manykitchens.com. Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie.
All right, we're back with Andy Ricker and JJ Good talking about their new cookbook, Pock Pock, just out from 10 Speed Press. It is a beautiful book, great for any food lover on your list this year.
Yeah.
So we were just talking a little bit about the word authenticity and what it may or may not mean to the foods here. But one thing I thought was really cool was how you mentioned in the introduction and elsewhere that by recording these dishes the way they are made, we're at least keeping some of that alive in a generation or in a time when future generations may not be taking up their parents' or family's food business. They might be seeking other opportunities, going to school, and so forth. So we're at least it's written down.
I mean, the thing is that there are books on Northern Thai cooking in Thailand, in Thai. But you don't see a lot. You see random dishes in cookbooks in English. but a lot of stuff like lob, there's certain dishes that you just, I don't think I've ever seen a recipe for Northern Thai lob in a Western cookbook. Maybe David.
Maybe David.
What exactly is lob?
Lob is a minced meat salad, more or less. We use the word salad because there's not really a better descriptor for it. And there's a lot of dishes in Thailand that we don't really have an analog for here. You know, it's kind of so we use the whatever words we can to describe it. Right. Basically,
It's one of those dishes that it's helpful to point to lob when you describe regionality in Thailand, because lob or larb, as it's spelled on English menus in the U.S. In English,
in the Americans,
lob is usually the Isan or the northeastern version of this particular dish. Lob meaning just mince or chop, right?
Yeah, it's the dish. It's also a verb meaning to lob.
Okay.
But the northeastern version is so different in flavor than the northern version. The northeastern version is the one we recognize. It's got the toasted rice powder. It's got a lot of lime. It's got, you know, fresh herbs and raw shallots and all this stuff. And then you look at the northern version, and it's really so different. There are a lot of dried spices. There's often blood chopped into it. It's occasionally eaten raw by old timers.
They eat it raw in Isan also.
They eat raw in Isan?
Sure. Absolutely.
It has fried shallots and fried garlic.
So it's similar in the sense that it's a chopped meat salad, but totally different flavor.
Yeah, there's a big difference in flavor profile. And even within each region, in the north and the northeast, there's going to be big flavor ingredient variations.
Wow.
You know, from province to province, from town to town, restaurant to restaurant, house to house, everybody's got their own way of making it. But it's a very old tradition. I think the Lao people will claim that it originated there, but I don't know, the Northern Thai people might argue with that.
I think it's fascinating just how many different dishes, you know, you could say are encompassed within a certain country's parameters and so forth. It sounds like, do you still go to Thailand once a year now? And
I go a couple times a year.
Wow. Still just try to seek out things you've never tasted?
I don't really have to try that hard. It just shows up. I mean, the trick is to go at different times of the year, because just like any other great cuisine, there's seasonal differences too. So, for instance, I went recently in January last year, actually, which is the cool season. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been there in the cool season for a while. I'm actually going back this year at the same time. And the cool season isn't the greatest time to be there for food, because you know, a lot of the tropical fruits that are so good aren't available, and there's other dishes that are, you know, some of the jungle herbs aren't as available then. But you still find stuff. So this time I found this cauliflower curry that was delicious, and gangdokalam.
Gangdokalam.
Dok meaning flower and galam meaning cabbage. That's what they call
cauliflower. Flower cabbage. Yeah, that makes sense.
Cabbage flower.
Cabbage flower.
Yeah, that's what they call cauliflower. And
it's not too far from our definition.
Right? Yeah, cauliflower. So anyway, it you know, I had never had this dish before, and it wasn't that it wasn't there, it's just I didn't notice it before.
Yeah.
And it was right there alongside of all this other stuff that I knew, but I was like, what's that? Had it, and it was great. Tried to make it there, came out pretty good, and it ended up on the menu last winter at Pok Pok. It probably will do again.
That sounds great.
But it's cool, like, even after so many years of going there, and so many years of going there with people who are from Chiang Mai, and are, you know, introducing you to new stuff, still, he constantly is coming upon stuff that is new, or new to him, or...
Mm-hmm. And what is the best way to navigate that and seek that out? I know you speak pretty good Thai, but you did say also, like, in your earlier travels in Thailand, you would often find foods that were just as slightly different than the foods you'd see in American Thai restaurants. It's maybe a better version of it, until you kind of sought out and, you know, tried these foods that the Thai people were eating. Mm. So how do we do that?
It's tricky. Travel? It's very tricky. I mean, the whole thing is kind of opaque to the average tourist. Mm-hmm. Even if you are actively seeking food out, your best bet is to try to find a blog. Like okay. our good friend Austin, who did the photos, he has a fantastic food blog that you should check out. It's at austinbushphotography.com. But Austin's a weird bird. He's almost like a Thai food savant. He's been there for like 15 years. He speaks the language. He speaks a bunch of different dialects. He's really into the food, and he like goes and finds this stuff, and he writes about it on his blog. But aside from that, how would you know? The probably the best places are going to be, restaurants or roadside places where the signs are in Thai, and the Thai alphabet is not the same alphabet as ours, right? So it's basically unreadable. I can't read Thai, which is a big problem for me. And even if you speak Thai, you have to know the dish that you're asking for or looking for, right? And you have to know and even if you have a really good Thai friend who's like, oh, I'll take you to all the good places, you're going to end up eating tom kha gai still. Because a lot of times, because the Thai people at a, sort of this very base level have a hard time believing that we Westerners are capable of eating the food that they eat. And also Thai society, they're very much want you to enjoy your time in Thailand and to enjoy the food and to think it's delicious. And if they serve you something and you kind of like turn your nose up, it's right. like a big fail for them.
Yeah, right.
Totally. And they don't want to fail. So,
and to be fair, most tourists,
people probably wouldn't,
those who think they want to try something don't really want to try it, or at least they, when they try it, they're like, ooh, I don't know about that. I mean, I had that experience a couple of times when Andy would introduce me to a new dish. And, you know, I'm used to eating pad see ew and pad ki mao and all that stuff at, you know, Western Thai restaurants.
Some of the food you tried, like, just blow your sock, or in a bad way?
Not in a bad way so much as a, like...
Surprise.
It was really surprising.
It can be a little shocking to the palate. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's really interesting and delicious are things that we've been kind of taught as honkies growing up in America. I mean, it's, you know, we're changing demographic now, but, you know, as a honky American growing up, the idea of even eating offal is a difficult thing for some people to overcome.
Right.
Or even eating a whole fish with a head and a tail on it. I mean, it's pretty benign and, you know, but even that can be difficult for us.
Not to mention, you know, herbs that taste so bitter that makes you think you might have been poisoned.
Right.
If Andy wasn't there to tell me that I wasn't poisoned, I would have taken myself to a hospital.
Let alone eating raw blood soup
with
minced raw pork and offal in it. I mean, that's, you know, you're pushing the boundaries of what, you know, even people who grow up around things that are a little bit.
Well, I guess it's good to see, though, that some people are eating it and enjoying it, so
Well, I think
a matter of perception.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as a society, we're changing a lot, and we've become much more adventurous in our eating. And I think it's just a matter of convincing the people that know how to make this stuff to make it.
Right.
And the
hence this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just a kind of random question. How did you come up with it's on the back cover, chicken wings recipe?
Okay. So the story with that was I was in Vietnam traveling right before I opened Pok Pok, about 6 months before Pok Pok
in opened. Portland.
Yeah. And it was, I knew when I left on this trip that I basically had, this is my last big trip before I was going to open a restaurant and be, you know, stuck handcuffed to the place for years probably.
Yeah.
So one of the places I went was Vietnam, and I had this dish at a little bia hoi stand. Bia hoi means fresh beer in Vietnamese. Mm. And you sit on these little plastic stools. They've got a big, huge vat of like room temperature beer that's weak, and they serve it to you in jugs, and you get ice cubes. You get a bucket of ice, and then they'll have snacks along with it. And they had like a menu that was like paper with some magic marker on it that said, and one of the things it said was fish sauce wings in English. And I thought, how could that be bad? So got them, and it turned out to be one of the best things I'd had on the whole trip. And so I scribbled it down in my notebook, promptly lost the notebook. It was terrible. It was devastating. I lost like a whole
month, all your notes about
all my notes for a month's worth of travel in Vietnam just like that were gone. And so I had to try to reconstruct it from memory. And like, I actually only took a picture of the table after I'd eaten everything. There's a picture from that,
that particular That's what day, I
but there's like, it's like empty plates. So when I got back, and long story short, Pock Pock opened as a shack and then later on became a restaurant. It wasn't until we opened the full restaurant that these came onto the menu.
Okay.
And, so development, basically friend Ike, who worked with me, helped me figure out the recipe for
He's Vietnamese and his name is Ike or something Ike, like that, Ike, right?
Yeah.
But they call him Ike because who can say Ike? But it's funny, the irony is that, of course, like, it's one of the most popular dishes at Pock Pock. And
it's the most popular.
It's the most popular. Yeah. I didn't want to say that because I thought it would hurt your feelings.
It is.
But it is also one of the few dishes, one of three or so dishes on the menu that's decidedly not Thai, straight up Vietnamese.
And who would have known after, you know, cleared up plates and no notes to speak of that that would turn out such a good recipe?
Yeah. I mean, well, it wasn't instantaneous. We had to work at it, and we worked at it and worked at it and worked at it over the years. And it you know, finally got it locked down a couple years into it.
And that one is so doable at home.
Oh, good.
So
good.
Yeah. You've been making it at home?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, thank you so much for sharing these recipes that took so much time and research and traveling and new experiences, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed reading about all the wonderful people throughout your visits and travels too, so thanks much
for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's about all the time we've got for today, so see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.